Today I'm in Old Fort, Tennessee to visit my good friend Blake Reimer of Tennessee Mountain Farm. He's one of my first friends that I made here in Tennessee, and we bonded over regenerative agriculture. I found out he knew about Korean natural farming, and he has a no-smell pig pen, multiple of them, so we'll get to dive deep into how to raise pigs without any smells. He's a multi-generation farmer, and we're gonna get to learn all about some of his story and how he went from a conventional commercial chicken raiser to now full-fledged regenerative farmer, raising sheep, pigs, chickens, and cows, all using holistic management. Hey, Blake.
Hey.
What's going on, man? Good to see you.
Good to see you too, buddy. Welcome back.
Yeah. Tell us, I want to know more about your story. Yeah. You know, I've heard it, but I think your story is just so interesting of how you came to be a regenerative farmer.
So I like to tell people the story of me being here starts way before me. My great-grandmother was married in the front room of this house in 1912.
Wow.
And then she came back and purchased the farm in 1933 as a widow with seven kids.
My
grandfather was the oldest one of those at 18, and they basically homesteaded here. it was 64 acres of a farm, and he worked here. All the other kids worked here. She worked here. I have a nice family book that tells me the fun story of how great-grandmother would have to get up earlier than everybody, start two fires, one for the house and one for cooking, and then go milk two cows and then come back and then make breakfast for everybody. So that's true homesteading is what I think of here.
I think we're going to sit down, guys. It's going to be a real scorcher today, over 90.
Yeah. Welcome to Tennessee in June. Yeah.
So I wanted to get into Blake's story here first, and then we're going to go walk around and show you all of his different farming systems and how he's doing everything, because I think he's got a lot of great ways that he's doing things where, and he's gone through a lot of trials and troubles and figured out a lot of different things. I think it's going to help everybody.
I like that word, systems.
Yes.
Right? I set up systems so that it makes life easier when they work the right way.
Mm-hmm.
So
tell us more about your story, because when I met you, you were still doing commercial poultry at that time.
Right.
But you were super into regenerative agriculture. You had dreams of doing way bigger and better things. So how did it all come about?
Well, whenever I moved back 6.5 years ago, it was what I thought was to help my parents manage their commercial chicken business while I did Joel Salatin organic style chickens that I'd heard about on YouTube. And the idea of getting paid $35 a chicken instead of 35 cents a chicken seemed to be like a better economic model for me at the time. Just good enough to try. And when I came back to the farm from Louisiana, we lived down in Baton Rouge for a couple of years. And the reason I came back is because Mom and Dad had lost their contract with the chicken company that they had been growing for 35 years. Mm-hmm. And that's a typical, sometimes, sadly enough, a typical story that you hear of a farmer working for the corporation all those years, and then at the end, maybe their barns just aren't as efficient at converting corn and soy into chicken as a brand new barn, and so the chicken complex wants them to spend a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Unfortunately, at that time, they'd been out of chickens for so long that Dad didn't have life insurance, and then they were about to borrow more money at 70 years old to keep on growing chickens. So I called Mom and I said, hey, we need to talk about what's going on at the farm. It seems like y'all are just struggling to do the work and nothing that they've done, right? It's just time.
Yeah.
And so I offered to come back and take over the farming operation, but it was gonna have to be a big change from the way it was going. And they agreed to that. And so I left Louisiana and moved back. And in my mind, I thought I was going to help them raise their commercial chickens, and I was going to go in the back 4 acres and raise my organic birds.
Yeah.
And, you know, start my regenerative farming path.
Mm-hmm.
And Dad passed away very quickly when I came back, just to health reasons.
Yep.
And that's the other reason I was transitioning back, is his health was not great. It was really struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And so I quickly found myself being a commercial chicken farmer.
Yep.
But I just came out of corporate America, And I had a very renewed disdain for corporate America. And I think when I was raised here, we were always taught, like, you were always straight up honest with everybody.
Yeah.
There's no room for any other way to live.
Mm-hmm.
And what I learned in corporate America is if you are just straight up honest with them, then they are not playing by your rules.
Right. They're trying to squeeze every penny out of
every
little part of their business.
It's about profit. It's just about the profit. And so when I came back, it was a substantial debt of $640,000.
Mm-hmm.
The farm was about 6 months behind on the farm payment at that time. It was teetering really close.
Wow.
And so Dad passed away, and Mom and I became really good partners in this farming business.
Yeah, yeah.
She's a hard worker,
as
you know.
I don't think I've ever seen his mom sit down once. She's always doing something.
People tell me, like, why do you let her mow the yard? I said, let her. You try to go get her off the mower. I ain't doing that.
Yeah, it's 70. How old is your mom now, 76?
She's 75.
Okay.
Now, yeah.
On her stand-up mower going
around. Yeah.
She does a good job, too.
Yeah, and the gardens, and, you know, my niece Sierra helps her with the gardens, too.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we went to growing chickens, and it was something that I knew how to do because in another time of life, I tried to help him with the chicken houses, and it just turned out we realized that we could either farm together or we could have a relationship together.
Yeah,
we couldn't do both. Like, both of them weren't going to happen. And so that's why I left to go get a corporate job.
Mm-hmm.
We'd rather have the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so here we are growing commercial chickens.
Yeah. And I got to see that firsthand, actually, when I first moved here. I got to go inside the chicken house and see what that looks like.
We should tell people what that is, by the way, the scope of it.
Yeah, are you allowed to talk about it?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Well, no, I can talk about the scope of things and what it went on. I can't talk about everything, really. But because of my corporate experience, I had a different view of mm-hmm. economics than I had before.
Mm-hmm.
And we were also able to buy another farm out of bankruptcy that was one song on the radio that way.
Mm-hmm.
That's my best way to describe how to get there. And I was able to buy that at about 30% of market value with my bank funding everything after a year and a half of me turning things around
mm-hmm.
here. And then I was able to sell that farm to another local young man at only 90% of market value because that's what fit the budget for what would make the farm cash flow for him.
Mm-hmm.
I could have sold for more, but it just didn't make sense to me because they weren't going to cash flow any more than that.
Yeah.
And then we were able to use the difference there that we made to finish paying off the debt here. And as soon as I was able to secure the money to pay the debt on this farm, mm-hmm. I didn't grow a single flock of chickens for the chicken company after that.
Nice.
Now, let me say this. There's always like two versions of things, and sometimes there's truth in both of them.
Mm-hmm.
So my version is I quit growing chickens for them. And that's very true. The way that I did it was to force them to fire me. And so they could say they fired me as a grower, and that's a very true statement.
Uh-huh.
They just didn't know that I was making their legal team out in Greeley, Colorado, do a whole bunch of work to tell me why my contract was invalid.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I wanted to see was their contracts aren't any good anyway. All these farmers are like, I've got a 5-year contract or a 10-year contract. Well, tell that to the guys down in Laurel, Mississippi that were growing for Sanderson and they sold out to the big conglomerate and now they don't have a contract.
Wow.
So,
Shady.
In my vision for the farm of being a regenerative farm, we don't have bad smells around here anymore because we're a regenerative
mm-hmm.
farm.
Mm-hmm.
This winter, I didn't have any mud because I'm a regenerative farm.
Wow.
And so the chicken house operation became an obstacle for me gaining more revenue sources. And so whenever I was able to shut those barns down, then I was able to start putting up camping spots and RV spots where agritourism brings people in.
Because you're not allowed, when you're running the houses, you're not allowed to have other things going on.
Yeah, I wanted to have agritourism, and they would not allow other people to be on the farm.
Right.
When I got chickens, it was usually between 105 and 115,000 chickens at a time.
Yeah.
And I did that six times a year. And so I was producing 650,000 chickens when it was just this farm.
Yeah.
The other farm added that to it as well. And so there was a time where I was producing 210 to 225,000 chickens in six times a year.
Wow.
I think my biggest year was something like 1.1 million or something chickens in
birds.
One year to
That's
the
a lot
market.
Of birds. Yeah.
And so that it was a, and I was small scale.
Yeah.
Like that big scale is small scale in the
yeah.
poultry industry. Today, if you built barns, you would have to build at least room for 250,000 chickens.
Wow.
4 to 6 big houses at $500,000 to $600,000 a piece to be able to make about a $50,000 to $60,000 living a year.
And the farmer takes that debt on, not the
That's
company.
That's right. Yeah, you put your farm up for it.
Wow.
And so back to some of the other parts of my story moving here is I was kicking around in Louisiana working for Drive Medical. Thank you, Drive Medical. Y'all were great. If you need a wheelchair, they'll get you. And I was over the state of Louisiana and the coast of Mississippi selling medical equipment to the market, not selling to people. I was a provider to the market. And life was good. Like, I had made a life down there, good friends. The opportunity that this corporation gave me was fantastic. But whenever they lost their chicken contract, it just started not setting right with me that I knew the next step was going to be bankruptcy. And then once you go through bankruptcy like that, the bank owned your land. And then someone else was going to be here. And my guess, with a mountain view like that and 15, 18 acre field up front, there was going to be like 20 houses put in that front field.
Oh my
like
God,
that's the way it was going to go.
Yeah. And this has been in your family for 100 years.
Almost 100 years, yeah.
That's a big loss.
And so
that's happening all over the place.
I just couldn't stomach the idea of it going away. For like four generations of very hard work and a lot of emotions and energy being put into this. And so that's why we came back, was for that. And then when I came back, it was set up as a commercial farm. Like Dad had done a big transition from it just being empty land to infrastructure, power, water. He put three wells in. Like he had set up a lot of infrastructure for the commercial business. He had cows that were on the land that he leased the land for grazing, but it was the same stock set. They have access to the whole farm. And so as I come back, I'm growing chickens. I start with pigs. That's my first, like adding more animals to the farm. I started with pigs. And when I started there, again, I had to go to the chicken company and ask them for permission to grow pigs on my land.
Right.
And make sure that in my contract, pigs wouldn't get me kicked out of their contract. But I did get that, like that got approved. And so Mom and I got us some Yorkshire pigs from the Mennonites here to learn how to raise pigs. We were wanting to do in netting and be able to move them on the land. I'd seen that, didn't know how to do it. And in my pig journey, And this will be the same thing in all the animals that we're going to talk about. I wanted something that was special and unique to set myself apart in the market differentiation. And I'd heard about these Mangalitsa pigs. and they seem to be super special. Long curly hair, really nice fat. It's supposed to be the Wagyu of pork, if you will. And Mom and I were at Benton's Country Hams in Madisonville, Tennessee, a great place to buy smoked bacon and country hams. They've been doing it for a couple generations as well. And we walked in there, I said, hey Mom, that's the owner right there behind the counter, this 65, 70 year old man, and Mr. Alan Benton. And I went up to him, I said, sir, would you mind showing us the bellies that you have hanging back there? I wanted Mom to see like this scale of so many bellies. And so he was like, heck yeah, come on back here. It turns out he just got a new bacon press, and that's something you put a whole belly in, it'll slice it, separate it, and package it. And then, so he wanted to show off this new toy, and I don't blame him, it was really cool. And we saw a ham hanging with the leg and the foot still on the ham. Mom's country, she grew up on a farm, but she went, why is that foot still on there? He said, oh, that's some specialty work I'm doing for a restaurant in Raleigh, North Carolina. We cure those for 30 months. And I was like, whoo. So I like asking questions. And I said, well, hey, have you ever heard of these curly-haired pigs? He said, oh, you mean that Mangalitsa? Yeah, that's the one. You've heard of it. He said, oh, I've even been to Spain and tried them. I went on a trip over there to try that Iberico, and they had some of that Mangalitsa. What'd you think? Like, I want to know. Mm-hmm. He said, I tell you, it's good, but it's just too fat. Mm. He said, I'm telling you, there's a lot of fat. And I said, well, what's your favorite pig? Oh, I like that Duroc. Why is that? The big red pig. He said, yeah, they got long bellies and big hams. That's what I sell. You know, I guess if a man crossed that Mangalitsa and Duroc, that might be the best pig I could imagine. Anyway, let's go look at these bacons.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he wasn't telling somebody what to do. He was just thinking out loud.
And that sparked something inside
we,
you.
We got in the car, and I just, before I started the car, I said, well, we're going to find some Mangalitsas. We're going to find a Duroc, and we're going to cross those and see what we get.
Nice.
So that was 5 years ago now.
Yep. And we're going to go see those pigs that he's been breeding for years now. And I've got to raise some of them as well and harvest them with Blake. And so, yeah, it's been a whole fun thing to watch and experience because the meat is incredible, the marbling, the everything about it. I mean,
I'm biased. I'm biased, but I think it's the best.
It is. It really is.
I like it for my family, you know. Yeah. By the way, when you get into wanting some special kind of animals, it takes a while to acquire them. Like it took me 4, 5, 6 months to find a breeder that would sell a Mangalitsa at that time. It happened to be in southeastern North Carolina or something like that. Like it was way over there. And we had to go over, or we got to go over and see grandkids, Stephanie's grandkids in Charleston. And I said, oh, hey. If I can get my Yorkshires to stay in an electric fence, I can turn this into a pig trip too.
Oh, no.
And so on the last day, my Yorkshires finally stayed in electric netting like they were going to. I called the guys like, can I be there Sunday and pick up those two pigs? And loaded up a trailer with a crate on it and picked up Stephanie and said, all right, you ready to go? She's like, what's the trailer for? I was like, we got to pick up some pigs. They're close by though. Don't worry about it. It'll be easy on the way back.
And she stayed with you somehow.
That turned into like an 11-hour trip driving back with those pigs and July the 4th. And it was like, we can't stop except for gas. And that was every 2 hours. We were taking stops. I'm like, kids, y'all got to use the bathroom? No. We're just ready to go. But I got the Mangalitsas. And then my first Duroc that I bought was from Red Hill Farms up in north middle Tennessee. And George was a great boar. He was super huge. He grew so fast. And I've learned in the pig business, like there's slow growing boars and there's fast growing boars. And he was a fast growing boar. He got up to about 750, 800 pounds in about a year and a half.
Yeah, he was intimidating.
But so gentle, right? I could ride on his back and he just walked around. He couldn't turn in circles because he's so big. He had to step away. And he did a good job for me. But then I got to talking to you, and you knew Cliff Davis, and I was like, hey, is there a chance I could buy a boar from Cliff? And it just all lined up so well for me to get a boar from him that is, you know, from a very special pig.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I've chased these things down. And then also in that process of trying to figure out the pig business, and I will tell any new person in pigs, do not breed pigs. Don't, if you're going to homestead with pigs for at least 5 years, don't get into the breeding business.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
Economically, it just wouldn't pan out for them. Plus, you got to keep them together, keep them separate, have different pens, keep babies away.
It's dangerous.
It's dangerous. We can talk about my tooth. And so I suggest just buy piglets in March or April or May. Raise them for 6 or 7 months. They'll be big enough to dispatch and make into meat. Whenever I came back, I knew that I wanted to transition the farm into something more regenerative. And I'd been reading a lot of books. When I first came back, I read Alan Savory's Holistic Management book. And it meant a lot to me at the time. And I'd been to seeing that there were conferences to go to learn these things. And so I signed up to go to the regenerative conference up in Crossville. I've been watching these Greg Judy videos for about a year at that time. and he's going to be a speaker at this conference. And here's a tip about how to get to sit next to your heroes at a conference. People are like human nature. They do the same thing every day. So Greg Giudice was sitting at a certain spot with his wife, Jan, chairs next to him. The next day, I just got there like earlier than anybody and went and put my notebook down next to the chair that he sat in the day before. He sat in the same spot. So I got to, you know, chit-chat with him some throughout the day.
And it didn't look like you were stalking him.
No, it didn't look too much like a stalker, I don't think. Maybe to the person that was sitting there the day before thinking, I'm going to sit here all weekend. Yeah. Better get here early. So I came back from that conference, and I told Mom, I was like, I think we need to start taking down interior fences. And I'd been doing some rotation with the cows through some temporary poly wire. Mm-hmm. And when you get started, you're using the cheapest poly wire. You're using like electrical reels to roll stuff up. Then you get a regular reel that's not geared. And then eventually after 2 years, you get geared reels. but you know, I was trying to drag water hoses around in fields, mm-hmm. divide things off in some form or fashion. And I go to this conference and like, if you'll get rid of your interior fences, you'll have an easier time managing things. And I'd been seeing stuff about the timeless fence post on Greg Giudice's channel and how effective they were at setting up a system that you could manage. And so a couple of struggling years to rotate things around, one really, and then I started taking down interior fences. And you take down a stretch, and then all of a sudden it opens up the farm a little bit. I'm like, maybe I'll take down this other stretch. And it opens the farm up a little bit. Well, maybe I'll take down that fence. And so I have a pile of 8-inch wooden posts mm-hmm, back here mm-hmm. from all the fencing that they put up that needed to come down for my system. You know, the hard part for me is choosing to take down infrastructure that I know took so much energy to put in. I know, like yeah. that's a hard.
But you probably helped put up some of it too.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure. I can remember standing there having to hold the post while my brother nailed the staple into it. And so as we started taking down this fence, Mom got more and more on board with how the farm was starting to open up and look. And so she was even the one to suggest that I take down the last stretch mm-hmm. right up here mm-hmm. For that. And then at that time, I was growing commercial chickens, and the NRCS is a division of the USDA that's there to help farmers grow better, mm-hmm. do better in commercial setting and also now in the regenerative setting. And they were out here to look to build me a barn to be able to hold chicken litter in, because chicken litter can be a biohazard if it's mm-hmm. just stacked up out there. When they came out, a barn had fallen down. Dad had some piles of chicken litter out, and I was like, y'all aren't gonna like get me in trouble there. No, we're here to help with this. So while they were here, we talked about the barn. I would qualify for that as a federal grant. And I just said, because again, I like to ask questions, what else you boys giving money away for? Well, there's this program we're trying to get started with, this cross fencing and water system, but it's hard to get people interested. I said, well, tell me what that's about. It's to do rotational grazing. And I was like, wait a second, y'all give grant money to do rotational grazing?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Can I apply for that too? And since I applied for both of them, it raised my score and I got awarded a grant to put in a fencing system and a water system. Mm-hmm. Now that was just the beginning of it, because what they expected is for the last 25, 30 years, you see the waters in the field that are the yellow tanks with the red top, mm-hmm. a concrete pad. And at first that's what they were saying, no, you put this in. I was like, I've seen these quick connects on the Greg Giudice channel. Mm-hmm. Can I put in quick connects in the ground? They came back and said, hey, we do cover that. We found out there is a place for that. You can do that. Okay. And so through that grant money, I was able to install timeless fence through the big sections of my center field. Getting a cross fence set up with a pressurized water line with the cross fence, so everywhere I move the animals at this time, they have access to fresh well water. And that has been a game changer yeah. for being able to do this. And really, ever since I went to that conference, I was trying to figure out, how am I going to do this? I knew what I needed to do just getting there. And since I was in the chicken business, I did have some time. Like, I had a revenue source mm-hmm. coming in to pay for things. But yeah, it took about a year to get through that grant process and get everything. But then I went to work and put my system in. Mm-hmm. And again, the more we put that system in, the more interior fences came down. And there was a day that Mom was walking down the driveway and the cows were right there with a single line of poly, keeping them in a place. And she looked frustrated. And I was like, Mom, what's going on? Like, what can we fix? And she just said, oh, it's just all those years we built fence. And we chase cows all the time around here. You put up this one little flimsy wire and they stay right where you want them to.
That's pretty amazing.
She was just, you know, and I said, you think Dad would like this? Oh, I think he'd really like this. So I was like, okay.
All right, so let's go check out some of these systems you're talking about, Blake, and see how easy you've made farming for yourself.
Oh gosh.
Quote unquote easy.
Easy, yeah. Let's, if you watch my Instagram page, you'll see I chase the sheep quite often. The cows that are in this field are not my cows. This year, I'm getting paid a daily rate to manage the cows on my land, and it's because I have the system of the timeless fence and the water line set up. And so with only around 30 to 32 acres of pasture, I'm able to put, right now there's 28 cows, 7 babies, and 29 sheep in the flurd. That's
flock and herd together.
Flock and herd, yeah. So in our area, typically they tell you that you need 2 acres to 2.5 acres per cow-calf. And so that would really mean I would only have stocking rate for about 15 here in a typical situation. But because I do daily grazing, and I'm able to move the cows off the farm in the winter. The cows are only on the farm from about April 15th until the grasses stop growing. And now that's dependent on the droughts. You know, last year we didn't get rain from the end of July until the end of October, almost 3 months with mm-hmm. very minimal, any kind of rain. So last year the cows left in August and they were off the farm for 6 months. But I do that so that the last bit of growth that we get in the fall is enough standing hay that my sheep have hay all winter long. Mm. Last year, I only fed 2 round bales of hay for the whole sheep flock for the winter time. So I'm managing the farm to try to get the most out of it when the grass is growing. And because of rotational grazing, I'm able to get this regrowth now in 30 days. That is enough for this many cows on about 1 acre a day. And so I'm getting like over 1 cow per acre in the system, which is 2.5 times of what you should have in here. But through 4 years of rotational grazing, I've built that up to be able to get that many. And now there's 2 different neighbors of mine that I'm grazing for here. They're 25 head in here of Black Angus and a Longhorn Black Angus. She's an old granny cow. She's been around forever. And there's 3 South Poles. Some of my neighbors were able to acquire some South Poles out of North Alabama, and they ran out of grass in the wintertime, found out that I was doing some custom grazing, called me and said, can we bring 3 over? And I went and asked the other cattle owner, right? He had a herd here. I felt like he should get to say, and he's like, yeah, that's fine. So now I'm getting to experiment with 3 South Pole and some Angus to see the difference, and there is a difference.
And the South Pole is the brown one out there, right?
Yeah, the red, light red. The South Poles are about 800, 850 pounds. The Angus are about 12 to 13, 1400 pounds in general. But I have noticed distinctly on a hot day, the 3 South Poles will be out grazing when all the cows are under the trees. Mm-hmm. And when they first came here, I was shocked about how small these cows are. And it was one of those things where, like, I knew the economics of it. I knew that because they're smaller, you should be able to put 2 or, you know, 1.5, or you can put 1 or whatever the math is. There are 2 Angus cows, you can fit 3 South Poles because the weight. And the economics are, if you've got that many more cows, so instead of 30, you had 45, that would give a small homestead farm, cattle rancher, more babies to sell. And they do make sense. But seeing them so much smaller, you're like, how does that make sense? But like I've seen now through a couple weeks of grazing, like they're just a more efficient cow for the southern area for grazing and turning grass into protein.
Interesting.
They're very good at it.
So tell me more about how much your soil has improved. You know, you said that you're getting more cows on the same amount of acreage. I'm assuming like the nutrient density is probably going up in the meat itself.
Mm-hmm.
And just for the land and just the improvement, you know, there's a lot of talk about how cows are bad for the environment and this and that,
yeah.
Which is completely not true. But tell us more about how that all works.
What I would like to say about those things where they say cows are not good for the environment, they're not talking about this.
Yeah.
Right? They're talking about a feedlot with 5 miles of cows packed in. That's what they're talking about. So this right here is not bad for the environment. I know that. As I started grazing cows, one of the things that I noticed is that they don't eat everything, right? They can get pretty selective. So if you bunch them up, it can cause them to graze everything, but you still have stuff in there they won't eat, or they, you know, you're having trouble with it. And that is the reason I got sheep.
Mm-hmm.
I originally got sheep just so they would eat the things in the field that the cows wouldn't eat. That has helped improve my health of the pasture. The main thing was buttercup. If you look around the south here, all the overgrazing that's done, continuous grazing, causes the buttercup in the springtime to come up into this beautiful yellow flower for most people, not for some farmer, because it's a disdain for me and mom. But I can remember 4 or 5 years ago, friends coming from Louisiana, and they were just like, oh, look how beautiful the fields look. And it was just invasive species of weeds. Like it was yellow flowers everywhere. And this spring, when they came back, they're like, where's all the yellow flowers? I'm like, well, there's still some there, right? I didn't get rid of all of them. But because of rotational grazing and letting the have rest, that it gives the grasses a chance to overpower the buttercup.
Buttercup is one of those plants that is sprayed for usually. So that's now something that Blake's not doing on his farm. I don't think he ever did, but less poisons as well. So when you're grazing correctly, all of these different species of grasses come up that are beneficial for the animals. And then now the farmer is no longer needing to spray any poisons as well.
So when I started with cows, they weren't eating those things and I knew I needed to add sheep to the program. And so I started looking at hair sheep instead of wool sheep. When I was a kid, we had wool sheep, and I did not like the way it tasted. Mm-hmm. And the reason I didn't like the way it tasted, because as we were bathing our lambs, washing our lambs, getting them ready for show, you got the lanolin on your hands, and I knew what that smelled like, and that's what sheep meat tasted like to me, is what that smelled like, and I couldn't do it. And I found out that hair sheep don't really have those lanolin glands to keep the wool oily. And so their meat can be a much milder flavor of red meat. And in that world of hair sheep, you've got the Katahdins, the St. Croix, several others, Barbados. And then with the Barbados, there's an American black belly. And I like this breed for a couple of reasons. One, they were a heat tolerant breed because they're from Barbados. Two, when they got to Texas back in the late 1800s, those boys put some horns on the males by breeding them with some white sheep. And then they bred them back to Barbados. So the American black belly has this beautiful rack of horns that comes out on all the males. So I was like, I think that's the one I want. Because I have neighbors that I grew up with showing animals that are wildly successful farmers that have a grand champion flock of Katahdins. And I just didn't want to compete like locally with someone who was already doing great stuff. Now, theirs weren't grass-fed, theirs weren't rotationally grazed and all that. But I chose the American black belly, and it took me a year and a half of searching to find a flock that I could buy that was somewhat local. I could find them in West Texas, and I could find them in Wisconsin, but I couldn't find them in East Tennessee. And so 2.5 years ago, I got a flock of American black belly. It was 5 rams and 5 ewes. And my goal with the sheep was to build up a herd of 40 ewes, because I felt like with 40 ewes, I wouldn't have to have the cows on the farm anymore to graze. My sheep flock would almost be big enough to take care of the grazing for that. I will say, like, the more I get into it, the more I want to lean into sheep and not so much the cows. Sheep won't try to kill you for the most part if you touch their babies. But they're just, I'll enjoy managing the sheep a whole lot. So I found the sheep, and then when I got the sheep on the farm, that's when I realized that a electric fence that was tall enough to keep the cows from jumping was too tall to keep the sheep from going under. And something too low to keep the sheep from going under, the cows would go over. So I had to do two lines of electric fence for a long time. And I was really, I was wanting to get to a one line fence for everybody, because two lines is just twice the walking doing it. So if I could efficiently teach them how to get to one line, it cut out half of my work essentially for the day, and would let it make it easier to move the animals. Mm-hmm. So this was a struggle, but I've come up with a system now using a couple different types of fence posts. And if we see, this is one of the earlier step-in fence posts that I got on the farm, and it had, you know, five spots down through here. And so what I do is when I'm using these, I go between the fourth and the third one, alternating the line up and down. And it's just about 8 inches of difference up and down through there.
Each post you'll
do that. Every other post, it goes up and down. It's okay. Like a W or a wave going out through there. And so far, it's not 100%, but in the last 2 months that I've been doing that, there's been very few days that the sheep have gotten out from this line. Mm-hmm. I've got a few places in the rest of my fence where they can find a hole through. Yesterday, I put them up three times until I finally grabbed a net and just put a net out in front of the place where they were getting out, and that solved the problem.
See, yeah, Blake's American Black Bellies, when he got them, I got a couple of them too and got to experience them, and they're just they're such a more wild sheep than the other sheep that I have, like the Katahdins.
I like the term exotic.
Exotic, they are. They are really beautiful. I'd say they're better in every way compared to Katahdins or St. Croix. They grow to slightly bigger size, better parasite resistance. They'll eat a little bit more variety of grasses and plants, but they're just more difficult to keep in. They take more management to deal with. So if you're willing to put in that extra effort, and like Blake has, and really figured out a system, then they are quite amazing. And my couple black bellies that I had, actually, they ended up teaching my St. Croix and Katahdins how to escape. So I sold back my mama back to Blake, and he has her here now.
Okay, I found the sheep down here, and they're not in the paddock with the cows. I don't think. Wait. Oh, wait, no.
Oh, they're
done. They are. I saw my neighbor has some baby calves over here in his field, and I saw some ears flapping, and I thought, oh, great, here in the video we're doing, my sheep are out. They are not. As we go down through here, the sheep have chose to lay down here in the shade. Oh, baby calf.
Oh.
Don't worry about him.
We just scare that one off.
Yeah.
It'll come back.
So I now have 29 of these sheep, and of those 29, only six of them are boys. So I'm to 23 females right now, so I'm getting there. August is my next expected delivery date of babies. And this year so far, I had 12 babies born, and of those, only three of them were males. And so that was a good cycle for me. So I'm expecting sheep again in August, and that's gonna put me closer to my 40 number. So next year, the sheep that are born probably in about April will be my first flock of sheep that I will be open to sell to people as breed stock.
Nice.
Because it's so hard to find these sheep. What I do with the sheep now, I keep all the females, and any male that I want to move out of the herd. Maybe his horns aren't as nice as the rest of them. I have one in here right now that has a white stripe on his side, and I love the white stripe. It's from those 100-year-ago genetics just expressing themselves. But I don't think that I want to keep that in the herd for a long time. And so when I first started dispatching the sheep for the meat, let me say that took 2 years.
Yes.
From the time I got sheep to the time I had a male that I could dispatch to try.
Yeah.
Was I even right on, do these sheep taste great? Turns out they taste fantastic. Such a mild red meat that it, but it, 2 years, and when I first started dispatching them, I didn't know how to keep everything that I could. And so I was composting a lot. And then it just got to me that I didn't feel good about composting a beautiful pelt like that without learning the skills of how to save the hide and make a rug into it. And so I'm about to dispatch the one with white, and I'm going to attempt tanning my first hide to make a rug that I can sell. I'm going to European mount the skull that I can sell, and then I'll be able to sell the meat as well. So by having three revenue sources off of one sheep, it's probably going to push me up towards the $700 mark per sheep that I can harvest here on farm. Now, there's a lot of work to go in with that, but I'm excited to get into saving every bit of the sheep that I can since I have this very specific breed.
What would be the average money someone could get? Probably $350 or $400 or something? Or what?
If you sell it live, maybe $300, yeah. Something like that. In today's market, they just had a big sheep and goat sale here, and mm-hmm. $300 to $400 is probably mm-hmm. doable. When I sell for breed stock, I think I'd like to get $350 per sheep live, but that'd be for a lamb.
Yeah.
And so that seems to be a good profit level for me. If I can get 40 ewes giving birth, if I can get up to a 2 lambs per mm-hmm. ewe, that would give me, you know, at least 80 lambs to sell at $350. It only took 3.5 years to do that to make money at sheep, but I see a path forward with making money with the sheep. So, Stephen, when we talk about, like, the transition of the farm to regenerative, where we are walking right now, I was driving a skid steer through to push down privet hedge 6 years ago. I couldn't even really walk through this area. And so you have to start, like, pushing down all the brush, then bush hogging everything, coming through and trimming off tree limbs and cutting trees out of the way. But I'm so excited about this little area because in really hot days like we're about to have, it makes grazing this super easy because the cows can come down here in the shade.
Mm-hmm. And everybody's then, down here.
Yeah, they've grazed all they want to. Their bellies are full.
Now they just like chew the cud.
They're just chewing the cud. Here's my set of triplets that were just born 2 weeks ago. You can see this mama in front here with the two ear tags. Look at her belly.
Oh, like, yeah.
You know.
She's probably got something in there.
We're getting closer. There's that ram right there. The white markings on him. His horns are beautiful. But because of the white markings, I'm going to dispatch him, but turn him, you know, into a lot of different things. And by the way, that's a year and a half old ram.
Nice. It's a good size.
The one behind him was a baby when they came here, so he's about 2.5. And I love the way he looks.
So your champion, your number one guy in there?
He is. Now, I still have Hercules over here. Hercules is 6 years old now. Hey, buddy.
He's real friendly.
Yeah, I can rub on Hercules. He likes it. He is from Wisconsin. And so it's nice to have some bloodlines that are from the Alabama, Mississippi area, and then his bloodlines in Wisconsin. He's, every couple weeks, he gets a little limp on his foot, and I gotta check him, but he's just older.
Yeah.
I decided he's probably not gonna go anywhere unless someone wanted him for breeding purposes. But Hercules, hey, are you gonna come up?
Mama.
That's about as close as they get sometimes.
I mean, this is pretty good because when you started out, we were not able to get this close.
No.
So they've really softened up and warmed up to you.
Now, let's go right over here and look. You can see this cow is drinking out of the water tank. And so a key for cattle to me to keep them cooler as well is to always have a good supply of cool water. If you have a big 500 gallon tank, which is usually what 60 animals like this would take, that tank is going to set out here in this hot sun and get really warm. And so they won't be able to cool themselves down by drinking water. They're just getting the hydration. And what I have is just a 50 gallon tank with a high flow float valve on it. And so as they drink the water, the valve goes down and starts filling up the tank again. And then whenever it fills up, and now we have cool well water in here. Feel that?
Oh yeah, that's nice. It's like 60s or something.
And I keep it right in the middle of the line for a very important reason. If I was to move this tank out just a few more feet, they would knock that float off of there. So the electric line gives the cows enough room to put their head down and drink water right here and then get back out. And they learn that if they start getting pushy and pushing each other around to fight for the water, they're gonna push one of them into the electric line. Then everybody's got their nose in the tank gets a pop. And so you'll see them like correct the bad behavior real fast. Like, no, you get out of here, you can drink later. But having the water line in the middle, or the power line in the middle, is really the key to protecting that water source. And then this hose is coming over here. To this quick connect that's just right in the ground. And so it's a male adapter that goes into a female adapter in the ground.
And was this part of all that grant that you were talking about?
This was, yeah, part of the grant. This was some of my leftover material that I was able to add a water line down here for this. But this was all through the grant money of putting this in. So this female line here is a pressurized water line that comes from our well, and it is always on, and it has this little yellow cap to put over it just to keep it from getting dirt in there. And when I flip that back, pull that piece of grass out and push that in, it locks in and water flows automatically. So I don't have any valves or switches or anything like that to turn. And then whenever the cows move over there, I have another one over there. So I just pick that up, dump the water out. And it's light enough that I'm able to carry it most places. If I'm moving it way across the farm, I'll come get the tractor and use it. But having just a 50-gallon tank and a water hose, I can usually lug that as far as the cows are gonna move. And then whenever like this comes up, that goes on, and I use an old plow disc as my cover.
Yeah, so if you were driving a tractor, you could just go right over it?
Just go right over it. If you're bush hogging down here for some reason, it just goes right over it. Right. Having a hole in the center of it is a big advantage, because what happens in the summertime is there's heat concentrated right here, and the fire ants love that concentrated heat, and they will build nests all around here. And so two or three times a year, I do have to come down and sprinkle fire ant powder around this spot to keep them away or get bit.
Yeah.
And having the plow disc like that makes it easy for me to take a little metal hook and pick that up and see if there's fire ants around it.
Yeah.
To move it out of the way.
The fire ants are really aggressive here too, I've noticed.
Yeah, real aggressive. As we walk down here towards the pig barn, I have two pig barns. It's that barn, which is where the pigs are, in the open barn you can see behind me there. And then in the chicken barn, I'm turning into my pig palace. And so as we get down there, we'll talk about the pigs and the pens and what the plan is on that. But we can walk through this field on the way there. This is gonna show a few different examples of what happens with grazing, and with grazing the flurred together, we're talking about mob grazing, keeping them contained in an area that has enough food for them for the day, and then moving them to the next area and letting this rest. This field has been a challenge. It was hay for a long time. It was a crop called switchgrass for a few years. That was a program Dad did with the state. But getting a lot of grass in here and not a lot of weeds has been a challenge without the spray. Out here behind me is a good example of what I've been battling with. It's called bull thistle, and cows won't even eat around it. If you have briars, and I see some of this right here, there's some of this in here still. It's horse nettle, but you can see the sheep have cleaned off a lot of the leaves on that. The reason that briars are not good for a pasture with cattle, thistle, horse nettle, is because as a cow eats, it takes its tongue out and grabs a whole swath and wants to pull it in. And if there's briars there, they have to be more selective with that tongue, and then they eat around it. It causes them to work more. And if anything the commercial chicken business taught me was anytime an animal is spending energy doing something besides gaining weight, you're not getting ahead. And so trying to get rid of those in the field is why the sheep are here, and also why I choose to do some real manual work. This bull thistle is just a beast of a plant. And this year, to combat it in this field, it started out about 2 months ago as it started expressing itself. And Mom and I would walk through the field with shovels in hand, little narrow shovels, and stick down beside the plant and pop it up and pull the plant out. And so I probably had 7 or 8 hours involved in that kind of activity, and you miss some of them along the way. You can see how many seeds are in that. They say it takes 7 years for this plant to go away, so we've got some battling to do. After the cows came through the next pass, as we were working our way this way, any of them that were still left standing, because it's pretty clear to see where they are, I came back with the tractor bucket and put it down and like pushed them down with the tractor bucket. So some of them scooped up out of the ground, some pushed down. And then another week later, more have popped up, and so I followed that with a bush hog behind the cows. So every time I'd move them, then I would bush hog that spot. So we've really been battling this stuff to get it out of the field. You know, you can see, like walking out through here, is there some buttercup? Yeah, I got some buttercup here. But 4 years ago, it was a field covered in buttercup. And so just through the animal impact with a combined herd and flock is what's giving me these kind of results. So the pasture that we're walking in, the section right now, this kind of grazing would be the 30-30-30 kind of grazing. I gave them too much area for the land is really what I did. I've been seeing a lot of different videos on whether you do the 30-30-30 method or whether you clear it all the way off. Mm-hmm. How do you manage this?
What does 30-30-30 mean?
That means that they're going to eat 30%, they're going to trample 30%, and they're going to leave 30%. The idea is that leaving the 30% gives you more canopy cover, more solar collectors to grow more grass. The idea behind grazing it down to 10% it's not exactly taking everything. I have a good example of this in the next pasture. It's about what they trample and take equals they've got it all. And the reason people are doing that is because it forces them to eat the cocoa. It forces them to eat the undesirable stuff. And when you move them off of it, the idea is that fertilization left behind mixed with the rest period is going to let the grasses outperform the wheat. And I'm starting to see that. So I'm not sold on which way is absolutely best for every farm. Like, you got to figure out what's going on in your land.
Right.
But this spring, as they were grazing, I noticed the closer I tied them up, the better off that they did. I had an electric fence right through here. And on this side of it, it probably reached like my optimal of what I like to see, because there's very little left standing.
Right.
But there's still a lot of cover on the ground. Like, if we look down through here, you can see, look at that. See how much covering there is on the ground down there?
And then what are the benefits of that?
So the covering on the ground, ooh, right there are some worm castings.
Nice.
Right there. The covering on the ground means that today, when it's going to be 90 degrees, it's probably going to be more like 80 degrees at the ground level. And the cooler that you can keep that ground, the less it's going to evaporate water and the healthier it's going to be for the earthworms. That is probably the most distinct change that I've seen since coming back on the farm. When I came back, you could stick a shovel anywhere and you might find a worm. There just weren't a lot of earthworms out here. And through studying regenerative farming and seeing what best practices can produce, if you can stick a shovel in the ground and pick up 20 worms out of a 1 square foot, that means there's probably 10,000 pounds of worms under the ground, and they're providing 1,000 pounds of nitrogen fertilizer to the ground in a very neutral 7 pH fertilizer base. And so now, if we stick a spade in the ground anywhere, we're going to find a handful of worms through the whole farm. And so I don't know exactly what's changed, but I know there's a change for the better. Next week, the cows are coming back to this field and they're gonna be on the roadside of it. You can definitely tell where they've grazed here and where they haven't grazed. And they need to work their way up that side of the field over the next 6 days. My issue with grazing them there is that cows need grass, they need water, and they need shade. And as you can see, there's no trees in this field. I have a plan to plant trees in the middle of it. So years down the road, I can graze where I want to with silvopasture kind of trees. You know, the thing you say about trees, the best time to plant was 20 years ago. Yeah. The next best time is today. Mm-hmm. So over time, that'll be where I can do that. But what I have to do now to graze animals on that in the summertime is come over and you can see the H posts or the two taller posts that are in the field over there. That used to be an H brace system, and I took all that down so that I can create an alleyway from those two posts across the whole field here and then to behind the barn that's over here where my pigs are. So at around 11 or 12 every day, I'll have to move the herd on that side, let them have shade and some grazing over there. And then at 7, when it cools down and the sun will be behind the tree line, move them back and let them spend like 12 hours, 18 hours back over there. So it's gonna be a long week of like setting up lines and moving stuff around. I would love to have some of those mobile shade structures, but with my herd size, I'd probably need 3 of them, and at $7,500 a piece, it's hard to justify that. I'll just move the animals a little bit. Mm-hmm. Look, I know we're gonna talk about wood chips at some point in time.
Blake's the wood chip king. He found the ultimate source.
Listen, this is a small pile of wood chips compared to what we're going to see. Welcome to my no-smell indoor Korean natural farming pig pen. There's some things about it you notice, like the pigs are raised up a little bit here. It's because below the wood chips, there's solid logs, and then below the logs, there's charcoal. And then in the wood chips, we inoculated labs bacteria, and the microbes eat away at the poop and urine smell, and the pigs feed the microbes. So I have two different things living here in symbiosis. Several things I like about it. A is, here, let me feed first, and I'll show you what I like about this. These pigs only need about 3 to 4 pounds of feed a day in this kind of system to maintain their weight. And it's just as simple as throwing in some scoops of feed. And since we were doing this tour this morning, I did not feed them breakfast so we could show this. And you can tell how they're a little hungry, but that's okay. So now this little boar is 75% deer rock and 25% mangalitsa. And I'm doing some breeding with him with some of the pigs to see what that turns out like. But I'm really excited about the way he's turning out. Mm-hmm. In the pen, you can see across there, they're running by, is a pressurized water line. And that is a well water that comes up on that nipple, and they can bite down on the metal nipple and drink all the fresh water they want to. And so, there we go. Gonna get a little drink of water. Because it's raised up and there's logs below it, the drainage just goes out the barn and doesn't get all of the bedding wet and through there. A benefit of taking the time and energy to build a pen like this is that we just fed pigs and it took a minute or less from the time you get here. And because I know how many pigs are in here, I know how many pounds are in a scoop, it's easy for me to tell someone else how to feed my pigs of, you know, half a scoop per pig in the morning and evening.
He's got the camper hookups, you know, where people can rent and stay on the farm. So if you want to come visit Blake and stay at his farm, you can. And, you know, typically you think of pig as such a stinky animal that you wouldn't be able to live right next to pigs. But do you ever, customers ever complain?
So with the RVs, a lot of my RVs come through a website called Harvest Host. And it's RVers that pay a membership and they get a free place to stay for the night as they're traveling. Most RVs are just one night stays and they're traveling through. And what they do is they agree to buy at least $20 worth of my farm product for the stay. And most of them average 60 to 80 in farm product sales. So it's like a farmer's market that comes to me and I don't have to pack up my stuff and go to a farmer's market. But that's been so successful that that one spot has generated enough to convince me to take down this barn right here. This is a commercial chicken barn. It's 40 by 500, so it's a 20,000 square foot barn. There's nothing wrong with it as a barn, but ultimately it started to not fit my vision of how I wanted people to be able to enjoy the farm. And so we're gonna put in 6 or 7 RV full hookups there that I would hope to be monthly rentals for people that wanna come and spend a month at the farm in their RV. Oh, we gotta feed the little pig.
What is that? Why is that one all by itself?
Okay, this one, look, it's all by itself because I lost a pig. That's what happened. Oh. They were 11 weeks old. I was getting ready to sell 10 of them to a returning customer, and I had 2 pigs left over. And I went away for a night, and I came back, and there was only 1 pig left over, right? And so luckily, I didn't sell all of them. I was keeping 2 for myself, for our family.
Yeah.
So there's 1 pig by itself here now because that's going to be our family pig. And he's been weaned off. There you go. He gets a little more food than everybody else.
He's growing.
And so this is what I call my weaning pen. Whenever pigs have babies, you want to be able to get those babies away from the mamas without you getting eat up like that sound we just heard.
Yeah.
And so I built this pen so I can take down these level of boards here and I can start creep feeding the babies in this pen and they learn to start coming through in the mornings. And then to separate them, it's just as easy as feed down there, come up here, close that off with some screws, and now all the babies are separated out.
And then when you sell them out of this thing.
Yeah, when I sell them out of this thing and they're easy to catch up by the back leg and mm-hmm. load them into crates from here. My first experience with pigs with babies, none of this was here. The pig was out in the green area back there in electric netting. And it was Carolina, it was this big pig right here.
She's been with you a long time, hasn't she?
She's been with me a long time. Yeah, yeah. So she was laying out there with her babies nursing, and I had a 10 by 10 dog pen set up in here that I was going to get the babies and put them in there and like wean them off. And so I see her laying down, all these babies are just nursing, no one's paying attention. I'm like, ooh, I can get one or two. So I grab 2 pigs up and jump back over the fence, and I'm thinking, huh, I got this made. I got 2 pigs squealing. She's in that electric netting. Yeah, she didn't stop. All she did is come here, that mouth wide open, going, ah.
Oh, God.
So I get into the pen. Like, I run into the dog pen after dropping the babies, and I have to close the door and let her calm down. And she's walking around the thing to, like, she finally just hops back over and goes back to the rest of them. But, whew, that encouraged me to buy or to invest in more time of how to set up mm-hmm. the structure to get piglets away from the babies or mamas in a good fashion.
This is why breeding, you don't recommend breeding for everybody.
No, not at all. You know,
especially your first time.
Well, pigs can be super dangerous whenever you get complacent about it. Like, I could get in this pen just fine now. I don't have a concern about it, but I probably would carry a stick with me, like, just in case, you know. But I can rub on all these pigs. But about 4 years ago, I had a Mangalitsa boar, and I had 6 of his other Mangalitsa females, and I was hoping to breed those together. And one day I was down and I was gonna feed him, and I had my girlfriend's son with me. He was 20 at the time. And I was showing him the pigs, and I was like, oh, look, this pig likes to be rubbed. And so I was rubbing his ears right there at the electric fence. And he relaxed and he relaxed and he relaxed so much that his nose touched the electric fence, and he got hammered.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, he's probably gonna be mad about that. Anyway, let me go feed. And I had a routine, just hop over the fence, drop the feed. The pigs just ate, that's all there was to it. Well, this day that boar decided I had shocked him and he was gonna get me back. And he came around behind the rest of them as they were eating and ran up And I thought he tried to bite me, but he actually stuck his tusk up the back of my leg, right at the knee.
Oh, my gosh.
And it ended up with 12 external stitches and 5 internal stitches. And I won the award that night at the ER. Like, sir, why are you here? Well, a boar tusk went up my leg. When I got back, people were like, are you gonna take care of him? I'm like, oh, he's probably worth $1,500. I know he did it, but it's my fault. And about 2 months later, he had been in with those pigs for 6 months and I had no babies. None of them were looking pregnant. He got outside the fence and wouldn't go in, and Mom and I weren't gonna get too close to him at this time. Yeah. I was trying to entice him in with food. He had eaten enough for the day. And I decided, either you're gonna take this food or I'm gonna get a bullet.
Yeah.
And he did not take the food. And so I ended up taking that tusk out of him. And so This is the tusk that went up the back of my leg and made a necklace out of it.
No, it's a great memory.
That's right. Don't do that, kids.
Yeah. So that's the dangers of pigs, man. It's crazy.
If you would like a boar tusk, I have several more I'm making into jewelry.
Oh, now we're talking.
Yeah.
Need my own.
One of the things that I get around here is food that goes to food banks, but it sort of goes bad on them. Like, there's a little bit of mold on that, so they can't put that out. Mm-hmm. And they are gracious and nice enough to come bring it to me.
Nice.
I do get asked often about what I feed the pigs, and finding a food source that's affordable and close and all these things is a very big challenge for a lot of people. And for a while, I was able to source bulk feed from a local non-GMO plant, and they did a great job for me. They'd even custom blend. For a while, I was just going wheat and barley, and you got to be very specific on what types of those you feed to the pigs for them to like it. And it worked great, but I could not figure out how to keep the rats out of the bulk feed. Mm. I think they were eating 300 pounds of every 2,000. Mm. And so my local feed store was carrying a brand of food that I'd kept on hearing, oh, it's non-GMO. I'd prefer organic, but the organic food has to come all the way from Kentucky on special trips.
Right.
And this non-GMO is coming here just regular order. And so that's what a Tucker Miller non-GMO is, their main base. And then fruits and vegetables from around help supplement the pigs. If we're talking about what I think is ideal though, right? There's the way you do things and the way that you think they could be done. And in my sort of searching for what makes a successful farm or homestead, specifically homesteading things where you're doing multiple animals, there's multiple things, I'm missing a key center pin to that. Like a linchpin would be an animal that you're milking. I just can't get around the idea of, I need to have, for me, 2 or 3 cows, just 2 or 3, so that there's always 1 or 2 milking. I would, 1 or 2 milk cows would make a big difference in what I could do around here with that product that the cows are taking grass, turn it into a product that I could turn the cream into butter and make a product that we could sell at the farm out of all the cream and just sell cream. But the whey could be going to my pigs and fattening my pigs in a product that I'm not having to buy.
Yeah.
And so as soon as I can take down a few more chicken barns and get a place for an intern to be here, and I can get an intern to be able to milk a cow, I would love to have a couple of milk cows for that. If you don't have land for milk cows, I'm just some nice goats. Goats give good milk too. But it does seem like for this system to be more complete and more profitable, milk is gonna have to be a part of that in the future.
And if you have grass most of the year, you're not paying for that.
That's right,
it's just the labor of milking. So.
Just the labor of milking. And I don't know that I'm ready to sign up for a milk. My great-grandmother did it, you know, every morning. I got so much other stuff to try to manage now. Yeah. I'm just waiting for an intern that wants to learn some real good skills.
Well, contact Blake, everybody.
That's right. Okay, welcome to the Pig Palace. This is a 20,000 square foot chicken barn that I've made my fourth version of Korean Natural Farming pig pen in. Don't mind the spider webs, they're around. But what we're walking past is my stored wood chips. The Korean Natural Farming pen takes a substantial amount of wood chips to maintain and keep the no smell going. In the past, there was a time where I ran out of wood chips to add to, and they all start disintegrating and they get down to the logs, and they're going to eat the logs as well, like just pigs, curious. And then my guys show back up. Now, when I say my guys, 3.5 years ago, I searched out the road crew that was parked locally to clear the roads, the trucks. And this search is several days long, where you got to find out where they're parking at night, go leave notes on windows with your address and your phone number, please bring wood chips, have big area. And they did show up, and then all of a sudden they realized that I had a concrete pad out there that they could pour these things on. So they loaded me up all I could stand on that. And it did last me about a year, but then they're on 3-year cycles, I thought. And so I'm like, whoa, I've got to source wood chips. And like the best you can do is $75 or $100 per load. And that's the delivery fee. That's finding free wood chips. And then all of a sudden the magic truck showed back up one day. And I was like, hey guys. And they said, you want more chips? Yes, I do. And then I'd already shut off the chicken farm operation. The commercial birds were gone. And so I showed them this barn. I said, can you dump them in front of this barn and I'll push them in? And they said, yeah, easy. How many you want? I said, I want to fill the barn up. Fill the barn up? They looked down. Okay. And the wood chips started showing up. Some days they were bringing 2 loads a day here. And I just get my 25 horsepower little Kubota tractor. And it takes a few rounds. You got to get from the sides before you can push everything in. And started storing chips in here. And then those are green chips, and I really need them dry, and that creates a lot of moisture. Mm-hmm. And so I'd spread them out on one side at first and give them about 2 weeks and then move the wood chips that got some air going in there. And then over time they would compact down as they, you know, dried out, and I would reshuffle stuff around. Sometimes I'd have to get a bigger tractor just to move more of it down. Sure. But I feel like now they brought me enough wood chips for the next 4 years. Wow. So I have like an abundance loaded up. The other way that I like to look at that is somehow I had a crew of 7 people that had $300,000 worth of equipment, and they were working all day to bring me wood chips that I didn't have to pay for.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
And so that worked out, but I just made good friends. You know, I made friends with them. I do like to provide them with sausage every now and then. A pack of ham, something specialty from the farm. They would like to spend their lunch down here sometimes so they could play soccer in my big yard. No problem. Keep on bringing wood chips. Yeah. Initial plan with having pigs in here is that the sows would have babies in here, and when those babies were weaned off, sows would go to the woods after they were bred and spend about 3 months in the woods and then come back to the barn. I think that would be ideal, but I've come to realize that I don't have the infrastructure in place to safely keep pigs out in the woods and have cows grazing and sheep and all that. And so right now the plan is that they would be in here the whole time, which is, you know, it's a confinement, but it's not really like the typical confinement. They got wood chips to move around with their nose. They make beddings. They get fresh bedding every week put on top. It's a nice system to be able to manage a pig operation.
It is. Yeah. It's a really cool combination of living floor systems. But it's, you know, more closer to commercial in some ways. Mm-hmm. Way less pigs though than a commercial barn would have, right?
Oh yeah.
They would be jamming.
And again, like we're in here and you can't smell.
I don't smell pigs. Anything.
Look now, Rambo. Oh gosh, the spiders came back. Yeah, pig. Rambo likes to eat from the bucket. Yeah, buddy, get you some. So now I moved him in here last week to breed these 4 sows.
So I thought this is really cool that Blake set up. It's like a little chute system. So when he's got to move Rambo or any pigs in and out, he can move them here, and then he's got a gate that he can close them in and kind of control things in a safer way.
So the doorway for this, I've tried different things, and a young man came up here and said, you know, Mr. Blake, if you just use pallets, you could control that a lot better. And I was like, the simplest idea. The doorway is just wide enough for a pallet to back up to it. And then when I want to load those pigs onto a trailer down that way, I just take this pallet up and I move it right here. And I put the trailer at the end of the alleyway. And the only thing the pigs can do is go out into the trailer. Or when I wanted to move Rambo from the other pen down there to here, I set it this way, went and opened up that door, separated him out. He came down the alleyway, and the only thing he could do was go into there.
Yeah.
And so this is a system that I designed based off of the Mennonites around here and going to look at their barns mm-hmm. and seeing an alleyway run. So it's in the middle of the chicken house, sort of on the side, and it gives me enough room to take my little tractor and get a scoop of wood chips and then bring it and dump it over the top of the pen to add more wood chips in with the tractor. Mm-hmm. In this barn, I started building out K&F pig pens in a different style than what I started with out there. Out there, they're in one big pen and I have to use gates to separate them. And it just causes some issues. It was hard to do. So building in here, I use the same principle as I did in that pen. Charcoal, logs, wood chips, microbes. But this pen is 16 by 16. I chose that because that's the length of cattle panels and it made it easy to build. And as we were building it up, I put a post in the very center of it. And I'll be honest with you, this was just not that intentional for what it come to use for, but notice it does a couple things. Having a pin in the middle, it gives those pigs something to scratch on. They rub on it all the time. But as I got a doorway over here that I need to get pigs to, I can bring in just a few panels, or I use a lot of styrofoam board, something for them to see. I can set it here and then just walk the pigs around this way and they go right out the door. Mm. And so by having something in the center as a pivot, it's made moving the pigs much easier. And then the water nipples work so well for me out there that I had water in the chicken house. So I put up a new water line with T-valves going down to each one of them in case they did break them, I could shut them off. What I found out is that if I put a water nipple down here and I connect something underneath it to protect it so they can't push down on it and they can't push sideways, mm-hmm. then these nipples have lasted for over a year in here. I'm protecting them with a 2-inch PVC with ties that go around it that secure it to the fence. And so they can't, movable half-inch pipe up there.
Ah, that's really smart.
And so each pen has a drop for that. So all the pigs have water. And again, this just makes feeding the pigs, walking through here with a bucket and a scoop, tossing however many scoops in per pig, and you're done for the day. Hmm. And so this is gonna be my future design for my pig palace. I do call it a palace because of the chandelier that's in here. But I plan on having 6 to 8 of these with 2 sows each. Mm-hmm. And then every month I'll just rotate Rambo to a new pen. And then by the time they're having babies, he'll be out of the pen to the next one down. Mm-hmm. And they'll be able to use the run to create a place down here for the babies to be able to get away from mamas, but go down and feed on their own. Mm. And so I'll have me a weaning pen at the end of this barn that all the piglets will be able to go to. That's giving me pigs year round. Yeah. You know, in this pig business, at first I thought that's what I should do, but then it's very hard to sell regular pigs past July. People are looking for a pig to grow for the year and be done with it, which is ideal. But as I got into specialty pigs, I just have a reservation list now of people that are wanting piglets. Mm-hmm. And I'm not great at being a pig farmer. I just get to experiment a lot. And so trying to figure out this breeding cycle has taken me with a breeding cycle with a K&F pig pen in a barn that can be moved, that I'm having to design sort of by myself, but with ideas from other things. It's taken a long time to get up to there, but now that they're starting to be built out, I can start seeing the cash flow on a more regular basis. We're back in the chicken business. you know, in my farm story, we were in chickens and then we had cows and we added pigs. Then we added sheep. And Mom said, please don't add any more animals till we figure this out. And I'm like, fair enough, fair enough. There's more I want, but... and then we got out of the chicken business, but as soon as we were out, I started raising chickens on pasture like I wanted to back when I first started. This is my like newest version of a chicken tractor, if you will. I used EMT piping, 3/4 inch EMT piping, and a product that you'd shared with me about Maker Pipe, the great connectors to make mm-hmm. it, and put together a very lightweight frame. I was using these last year to brood chickens in the barns to brood them. And when I was thinking about getting back into the pasture, I was like, ooh, I could use that structure right there. And if I just take two cattle panels and strap them over the structure, it would create a roof that would do the whole thing. And so then a tarp on top of that. And then inside of the pen, I can access it just by taking this gate down.
Oh, that's really cool.
And so that's connected there.
Yeah.
And so inside the pen is a pressurized water line.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the same water line that I was using in the commercial setup. And so it has a regulator on one end of it. You can run complete pressurized water and it drops the volume of regulation. And the chickens can peck those little red nipples
mm-hmm.
and drink fresh water all the time. So it's connected to a water hose and it moves with them. Right now is about a time where
almost got out.
I do need to empty the water line like twice a day, just as a regular chore,
mm-hmm.
Because it heats up with the sun and then they're drinking hot water, not cool water. So you know, a little bit of extra work there, but just the idea that they always have pressurized water is really nice. See the high tensile wire with the Gripple on it there? This is high tensile fencing stuff. Well, these Maker Pipe connectors are very strong, but the cattle panel being bent over when I started connecting the bottoms of it, it started pulling the pipes out.
Yeah, I've had that.
And so I was thinking, well, how could I use pressure to keep them in? And that's when I came up with connecting the high tensile wire.
That's smart.
And using that Gripple. And that thing, once you pull it tight, it can't go back.
And so just holds it all together.
That holds everything together, so I can pull from that end, and it's technically pulling the whole thing at one time. So there's one of those in the center and on the other end as well. In the broiler business, you got to determine what weight you're going to process your chickens. And my mom likes about a 3 to 3.5 pound whole bird. She likes a smaller one. But in the chicken, it has a growth curve to it. And so once it gets up to that 4 pound mark, it gets up to 7 pounds a lot faster than it got to 4 pounds. They start growing a lot faster and you get a lot more consumption of feed. Last year I experimented with letting some get to 7, 8, 9 pounds because I had heard, oh, if a chicken gets too big, it gets tough. And I wanted to know, is that true with everything? Like, is it a true statement? I don't know. So I grew some out to bigger and we ended up with like 6 pound whole chicken, 6.5, sometimes 7. Turns out a Cornish cross just stays tender the whole time. They just get bigger. And so I'm gonna let these probably get up to about a 6 or 7 pound whole bird, so 8, 9 pound birds before I dispatch them because I like the bigger breast and the bigger legs and all
that. So you just raise them out a couple more weeks?
Yeah, just add a few more weeks to it. Again, they're getting a Tucker Miller non-GMO chicken grower that I'm able to get at the local store as well. So I'm in with non-GMO and daily moves. We can see back here, I've had the chicken for 4 days, so they're gonna get moved this afternoon. Their first move, their second move, you can see they are pressing the grass down. The first day, I don't think they quite knew how to eat well, and then they figured it out on the second day and evenly distributing their manure across through there. And I just have this nice flat area to be able to truck them all the way down through here.
Right.
If they get to the end, we'll turn the pen around and come back this way. And so utilizing this area that I used to mow a whole lot to run the chickens down now. It's just a nice area out of the way to have the chickens. As the sun goes down, they're downhill in a barn up there, so they're getting some shade in the in the evening time, but I better fasten that back up. Okay, this is my glamping tent setup. when I came back to the farm, as I talked about earlier, Dad had built a lot of infrastructure, and I'm just trying to figure out the best way to use all that. Or take it down. Like, that's the two choices, use it or take it down. And with this barn, a nice Kwanzaa hut style barn, it was packed with just farm stuff. And as I started cleaning it out, it was at the time that I was getting out of the chicken business, and I heard about this glamping idea that people were getting into. And I was like, I bet under that barn I could create something that's really cool. And so ended up, once again, wood chips on the bottom of it. It was all dirt, but since I had wood chips, we put wood chip flooring in here and then built a raised platform and put this Davis Tent Company tent up. It looks like an elk hunting tent. It's made in Colorado, as most as I can. Let's buy American. And so I built the platform for it to go on and got some artificial turf to put on the platform. I wanted the feeling of you were outside even though you were under a barn and inside. I would love to show you inside right now, but someone's renting the tent. Oh. They're gone for the day, but I still don't go in whenever they're there. But to give you a visual, there's a queen size bed in there with tables on both sides, a chair, some extra lights, and an air conditioner. And so now this is an air conditioned glamping tent that we put on Airbnb, and it's pretty easy, glamping on the farm with AC. That's the title of it. But this is 2 years. I've had this for 2 years, and I only just put it on Airbnb. I think every now and then I'll post a story on Facebook, like available. But in May, I only had 7 empty nights. Wow. And in June, I only have 4 nights that haven't been booked already. The glamping tent through Airbnb is kicking in so much revenue that 2 of the other barns are gonna come down, and we're gonna be putting up 6 more of these. Now, not under a Kwanzaa hut style, but there's a friends of mine have built a new style using wood structure instead of the metal structure and slipping the tent over it so it'd be more of a front door with a back porch and front porch. But we're gonna have available for groups to be able to come here and have at least 7 of these up on the farm. So this is starting to lead to more and more people coming to the farm. And you know, the basic philosophy of that is the more people I can get here, the more meat I can sell. And that's what we're trying to do. So,
and educate them on the type of farming that you're
doing. It gives me a chance to show them like why it doesn't smell and what, well, where are the cows? Oh, they're back over here in this corner. Let's go look at them. And why do you do this? And so I get to tell more people that this is a different way. This is the old way that became different. When I first came back, I was telling Mom about my ideas of rotational grazing, and she handed me an article. And it said, a farmer suggested the best way to manage your cows on your land is to set up 30 paddocks, move them once a day to a new paddock. And that article was written in 1886 or something like that, right? So we're not doing anything new. Right. We just got new toys and new tools to make it happen in that way that they'd figured out a long time ago. Okay, so we're talking about the journeys that we get on in our farming experiences. And when I came back to a commercial chicken farm, all we had ever done is grow animals. We'd never processed our own animals. And a matter of fact, we probably bought chicken at the grocery store for 30 years, even though we grew chicken. And I just could not stand the idea of growing stuff and then not knowing how to turn that into meat. And so as soon as I came back, one of the things that I did do was get a job every week processing chickens with a guy that was 15 years ahead of all of us on the pasture-based system to learn that skill. And then I still do that today every week with him. We dispatch somewhere between 80 and 100 birds, and between 4 of us, we've got that down to a 3-hour process for 100 birds. And that's, we've worked on technique for a long time. And so then I got chickens down, and I said, I got pigs, it's time to learn how to do pigs. And that's sort of where we met each other, was another friend had some pigs, I had a pig, and he said, let's do 1 a day for 3 days. And that'll be 4 days of work, and then we'll get practice. And it was a great idea. I mean, that probably helped me more than anything with pigs, was doing 1 a day on a regular basis for a little bit. And we met that way.
That's how we met,
Then Kyle was just like, oh yeah, Steven, Blake has a K&F pig pen. And I said, you know what Korean natural farming is? And he's like, you know what Korean natural farming is? I'm like, come on over, let me show you my pig pen. So when we started doing pigs, the holdback to pigs versus chicken you can throw in a cooler and cool them down with ice. Pigs, you need a cool room to hang. So I started acquiring parts, and it took me like 2 years to put in my mind what a cool room could look like on the farm. And so we installed a cool bot, the two of us did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a video on the YouTube channel.
Link the video to it.
To learn how to do something like this.
But this is all styrofoam boarding.
Yeah, and all recycled, reused.
Everything recycled, reused. Even the 2x4s are from some farm project I took down. And we just built out a big Yeti igloo kind of cooler with it and foamed all the seams. And
Oh, it's nice in here.
Installed the CoolBot in here. Now it's flashing because my internet's out, but the CoolBot hooks to the thermostat from the air conditioner unit. And this is a 18,000 BTU 220 air conditioner unit that I ran my own line into just for it. Installed the CoolBot here, and the CoolBot tricks the air conditioner unit to going below that 65 degrees that they always shut off at and running until it gets the room down to 40 degrees. I just turned it on this morning and we were at 42 when we walked in. At the top of it, we put in these hooks at the top that go all the way through the 4x4s, and they have a nut and a washer at the top of that. And then we're able to be able to hang animals up on this right here with the gambrels. And so this setup let me start processing my animals, have a time to chill them down, and then turn them into cuts and or barbecue them or anything else. Like, it's been a turning point in my ability to turn animals into meat is having a cool room here.
Mm-hmm. And this is just such an inexpensive way to build something like this. You know, you can purchase these for thousands of dollars.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this was...
Or this for is, about $700 for a really nice unit and put everything else together with a little bit of work, right?
Yep.
You know, I will say too, we were trying to figure out a door system for this thing. And what I didn't want was something to roll over, because I take a cart in and out and I didn't want to trip over anything as we were taking stuff in. And the simplest idea is sometimes the best. Like, this just leans up against there. It's inside of a closed room already, so there's no wind blowing around in here. And it works really well just to close it up that way and use pressure to hold it closed.
Yeah, we were worried in summer maybe it'll get too hot, but it didn't.
No,
it held it.
Yeah, held all summer. So yeah. One of my last things to show you is my newest indoor no smell pig pen. Mostly no smell, right? We're getting there. But I don't need this. I don't need this at all. However, what I want more people to do is realize they can grow their own food. And my setup that I have going down there was too large in scope for people to be able to imagine doing it. And they would say like, well, I don't have a farm or I don't have a barn. And so I came to mom about 6 months ago or so with this idea, maybe 4 months ago. And I said, hey, you know we have a no-smell pig pen, right? She's like, yeah. And I said, I think I gotta build one up at the house, because I wanna show people, like, all you gotta do is have a carport and you could raise a pig. And she's like, oh, I don't know. And I said, well, imagine we get through with breakfast and anything left over, and you just go scrape it right off to the pig. She's like, I'm sold then. I like that idea. And so I built this pen up, and it is Korean natural farming style pen, like the others at the very bottom of it. Let's go right over here. I left spaces in the bottom because it's filled up to right here with logs. And so those spaces are given airflow to get under there, and then the wood chips on top. And then to control the smell, we inoculated it with labs. But then also I have a bunch of bedding that's fallen out of the other barn down there that's super inoculated. Mm-hmm. And so just to cover up when he poops, we keep a tote of it over there with a scoop and just dust it over at the top. And so a little bit of maintenance during the day to get rid of just a fresh poop pile.
But it is right next to the front door here, so.
Yeah, you come out of the kitchen and side door, and you're right here at the pen. And so this is just to show more people, like, you can grow a pig really close to the house, and it doesn't have to. Oh, yeah, okay. He's got to where he likes belly rubs a whole lot. I have a yearly family reunion. Like, we've talked about some of my story. We've had the farm since 33. Great-grandmother got married in 1912 here. Every year, that family comes back here for a reunion. And so it'll be 80 people or so coming to the farm this next weekend. And done it all of my life. And so this right here is my reunion pig. And then the little baby that's down there in the weaning pig will come up here, and we'll have another pig up here to show that. But, you know, I just wanted to show people with about 20 hours worth of work, and that's including cutting the logs and moving it. Like, installing this was only about 4 or 5 hours of time for me. Mm-hmm. But like all my other projects, I got an idea in my mind, and then I start sourcing material for that project and putting it around the farm so I know where it is. These 1x12s came out of the chicken house that I'm taking down. And so I took those down, separated them out. They fit perfectly with this carport. Actually, I didn't have to cut any of them.
Oh my gosh.
And then the old panels here just for support to keep him from pushing out on top of that. I have thought, could he jump over it? And he gets a little excited and looks up there every now and then. But, you know, so far we're doing good. We're not chasing a pig around the yard yet. Could you imagine him getting out and going to my mom's flower garden? Oh my gosh.
No. It'd be a disaster.
Yeah.
And you got the water nipple, same setup
over there. Same setup, water nipple over there. One of the unintended benefits that of putting this exactly where I did is that in the morning time, he has some sun that'll come to about this far in the pen so he can get back in the shade there. And then by the time noon comes, he's under a barn, and the house blocks the evening shade. So he's in the shade up here all the time, has a mountain view. So it's like a pig condo with a mountain view. He always gets guests and visitors to come up here.
That's funny. What has been the kind of local reaction, you know, when the mailman shows up or the different, you know, friends come over?
Just sort of the, whoa, is that a pig? You know, at first. And then when they come up, it's just let me show more people. Like, we can stand here and talk and have a good time and not be bothered by a horrible smell of pig poop.
Oh, it's fine, yeah.
So, yeah, it's been a good way for me to show the community, too. Mm-hmm. I've even had some of them drive other people up here just to see it. And so I am that crazy guy, right? Like, yeah. I'll put a pig at the house. But this is one of my crossbreeds. So he's a Mangalitsa Duroc cross, been on a nice diet. And typically, he's actually a little smaller than what I would rather dispatch at, but family reunions, like,
it's time.
Nice. So we'll say a poem by Wendell Berry for the hog killing, and next Tuesday he'll be dispatched, and next Thursday he'll be barbecued.
Excellent.
And won't ever leave the farm.
Wow. That's pretty special for your family to experience that.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, none of them are farmers, mm-hmm. and so they get to actually have this experience on a regular basis every year. And now they're seeing how things are changing. Mm. And so that's enough about animals. Let's go look at bamboo.
So before we talk about his bamboo, which has been a many year-long project, and there's a lot of cool ideas that he has to use that bamboo for, Blake has some social media as well. He does a YouTube channel. Where can they find you at?
Yeah, it's at Blake Reimer. For YouTube and Instagram, or Tennessee Mountain Farm, but it's Tennessee Mountain Farm. Like, it's a jingle. You can't just say it, but it's TNMTN Farm because mm-hmm. there was no way I was going to have an email address that long.
Yeah.
But yeah, at Blake Reimer and then TNMTN Farm also finds those channels.
Cool.
I will say too, my social media is just about the things I'm doing here. And I do not want to be a video editor. And so it's just single shot videos. They might be 2 minutes long, they might be 8 minutes long, 10, something like that. But there's no editing to it. It's just whatever I can shoot on my camera and show, that's what I'm trying to do. So I would appreciate a follow on that though.
Yeah, so go check out all his adventures and let's check out the bamboo.
When I came back, I started visiting some friends around town. And one of them had started dating this guy that had a bamboo grove, and we started hanging out a lot there, and I got to really enjoy his place. And when I came back, I decided, like, I want to do something like that. It makes a cool experience. And I didn't even know all the uses for bamboo at the time. I just knew that, whoa, it looked like a good long-term project. And I like 10-year projects. And so I took some shoots of his and planted them back in the middle of this 4.5 years ago. And so the first year we got a grouping of about 5 feet around and 4 or 5 feet tall. And then the second year it got to about 15 feet around and 8 feet tall. And then last year it got to about 20 or 30 feet around and 12 feet tall. And then this year was our big year of really expanding, where it is now probably 30 to 40 feet around, 50, 60 feet long, and up to 16 to 20 feet tall at the very tip of it. My canes are about this big around now. We'll see some of the new ones, but it's gonna get to canes that are that big around. Mom and I have an idea that maybe instead of glamping tents everywhere, we might have some teepees in the future, and it'd be really cool to use my bamboo to build a teepee structure out of. So what I do is we're letting it grow in this area to create a grove down here, and I'm cutting pathways through the bamboo as it grows to be able to walk back in through there, because the whole world changes, it seems like, once you get into the grove. The temperature definitely drops by like 5 to 8 degrees or more as we come down in here.
Wow, oh yeah, I feel it.
Right, there's an environment change when you come in here. And so you can see some of these nicer, taller bamboo coming in here. You know, so this is gonna be a place just to relax and hang out. But then, again, unintended benefits. We had more than 3 dozen yellow finches around the yard this spring that we've only had like 1 or 2 in the past. There's so many birds that live up in here. I'm looking to see. My Great Pyrenees hang out in here in the daytime when it gets hot. And then, like what you've taught me too about bamboo leaves and how nutritious they can be for the chickens and how you can train chickens better with those leaves. When I cut this in the wintertime, it gives my sheep something that's green to eat. If they run out of brown stuff, I'll just come cut a few bamboo stalks and throw them in with the sheep. Well, they just hammer after it. But really, it's just a project of something to work on to create. Like, I like to change the landscape to a betterment. And so we, 5 years into the bamboo project, and it's something that Mom and I have grown to be our project. Mm. And that's really nice. Yeah. Like when it starts growing in mid-March, every day she'll come out with flags and put how far out the bamboo has grown that day so we don't step over them as we go around. And we talk about how we're gonna groom it and train it and what we're doing with it. So it's been a real fun project to work on with her. Yeah, look at how nice this.
Oh, here you go.
This is brand new.
New them. So they get thicker every single year.
Yep. And they come up the size that they're going to grow out to. Like it was this big when it came up. But it won't get any bigger than this. This is the extent of this cane. It has about a 7 to 8 year lifespan, and then it'll die out, and I'll need to come trim it out to make room for new growth. And so a bamboo is not a no maintenance kind of project.
Right.
It's definitely like a yearly maintenance, and you got to keep it managed. But then once you manage it, it's a fantastic organism to have on the farm.
Great.
And the grove that it came from, like I know what it's going to look like in a few years, which is exciting to me. Everybody else is like, oh, this is so big. I'm like, no. They get 10 feet taller, right? It's going to get 10 to 15 feet taller than this. And so once it gets out to this area right through here, we'll just start mowing around it and keep it that way. But I fully expect this to grow even 10 to 15 feet taller.